Coming up on Golf Today, Justin Thomas gets his first win in nearly 3 years at the RBC Heritage. What were the keys to JT's resurgence? And can he put a scare into Rory at next month's PGA? And speaking of the Masters champ, it's back to work for Rory and his good pal Shane Lowry. They defend their title at the Zurich Classic of New Orleans. Will they be singing karaoke and rocking some beads come Sunday night once again? And the LPGA steps onto the major stage in Houston at the Chevron Championship. A full preview, some predictions, and how close is Nelly to winning again? Find out next on Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Hello, it's Golf Today on a Monday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week Magazine. Is this real? It is. I'm back in studio with you. It's been too long. It's been a couple of months. How are you?
I almost didn't recognize you, but I'm relieved to see the Golf Channel pay the ransom demand, whatever it was. What exactly have you been doing for the last couple of months since our last show together was Phoenix?
How about that? Been traveling, interviewing some players, seeing some great things in this game. But I've missed being in studio with you. But, man, I've seen a lot of things. Historical type things. Greatness from another UCLA Bruin. How about Jake Knapp shooting 59 in the Palm Beaches? That was epic.
You claiming credit for that one and for Luke Clampton here?
The newly minted PGA Tour member. I was actually asking for swing tips and short game tips from the young man from FSU. Fun getting to know him a little bit. I think he's going to be a future star. We know Ricky already is a star. I've been playing well, but it's been a little bit herky-jerky, not quite seeing everything fall the way he wants it to, but always good to chat with the Players' Champ from 10 years ago. And speaking of the Players' Championship, how about catching up with Carson and Jackson Daly? How about Nota, by the way?
You and Nota couldn't elbow me out of that picture fast enough that day.
And look at Nota. I mean, you want to talk about the ultimate, like, photo bomb. But it's been fun. It's great to be back. I feel like the season has been so fun. A lot of big-time players doing big-time things.
A lot of momentum, particularly in the last couple of weeks, particularly yesterday.
JT getting it done. Look at these numbers. More than 1,000 days since his last win, Eamon.
It is, and it's his 16th total, second most over the last 10 seasons, behind only Rory McIlroy, and his first 18-hole lead or co-leader to win on the PGA Tour this season. And after the victory, JT met with the media.
I mean, the hard part about it is it's just it's really hard to win. And I feel like I've been playing well enough to win for a couple of years, but just because you feel that way and you are, obviously, that doesn't mean that you're going to. I mean, obviously, to 23 was tough, and it was trying to work my way through it and get my way out of that. But It definitely, I feel like I was putting more pressure on myself even last year to win than I was this year. And I feel like my game is in such a better place and in a good spot to where I'm just really trying as hard as I can to get myself in a place mentally of just trusting and playing and just committing to what I'm doing and having the belief that it's going to be good enough the more often I get myself there. And I've done that couple times this year and hadn't been able to close it out. And you know, I even knowing in the playoff, it was like, you know, if it obviously I plan and hope and want to win, but if it doesn't, we're just going to keep plugging and try to put ourselves there next time.
Former world number one showing everybody why on Sunday. I was struck with his entire week, Eamon. He was kind of the protagonist right from jump with the course record tying 61. He did a walk and talk on Saturday, had the penalty called on himself as well and kind of explained the reason for it. And, of course, Sunday closing out that first win in more than 1,000 days. He was front and center for the entire week and kind of a reminder of when things are firing for him and the flat stick was the biggest reason he's as good as anybody in the world.
And the penalty I don't think should be overlooked when you have an athlete calling a penalty on himself when he's clearly so desperate to win as he has been now for almost 3 years. So I think that was a particularly admirable moment for Justin Thomas and for the game in general. It was striking to me, he's always had the cockiness.
Yeah.
Never always had the confidence along with it, and certainly not in the last 3 years. There's been a lot of kind of shell shock activities for JT over that time. You know, he had to be a captain's pick for the last Ryder Cup. He was left out of the President's Cup last year entirely. He did not even make the FedEx Cup playoffs last season on the PGA Tour. He dropped out of the top 30 in the world rankings. In fact, when we ended the Tour Championship on September 1st of last year, Justin Thomas was ranked 33 in the world. He's now back up to number 6 on the strength of a lot of these finishes. I think the only thing that's missing in the puzzle piece for him right now is those strong finishes in the very biggest events. You know, he was tied 33rd at the Players, tied 36th at the Masters. You got to assume this boost of confidence might actually improve when he goes to Quail Hollow, where he does actually have, obviously, some pretty good history.
Yeah, got it done at the PGA in 2017. I just think about this kind of part of the PGA Tour schedule, what we've seen the last couple of weeks with Rory McIlroy and his emotion, and JT, obviously less voltage, but it had to feel like a long time coming for him when you're seeing the Scottie Schefflers and the other players being where he wants to be, and the confidence. I think you make a great point about kind of how he viewed himself, and he was always kind of someone who viewed himself as Tiger's heir. You know, he was the protege, and to go more than 1,000 days without being with a moment like this, it had to be humbling when you're the guy waiting for the phone call from the captain, when for the first part of your career, well, he's going to be on these teams forever. Both he and Jordan Spieth, I mean, they were kind of golden children. They'll be carrying the President's Cup and Ryder Cup teams for the next decade and a half, or so the thinking went. Instead, it was a big serving of humble pie.
It was, and it's also worth noting that of the 6 automatic qualifiers for the Ryder Cup team for this year, Beth Page, that victory yesterday moved Justin Thomas into the 6th automatic spot. Yeah. So you got to assume that was on his mind starting this year. He is one of these guys who sets goals, and he's actually open about the goals that he succeeded at and failed at during the course of the year. In the last couple of years, there have been a lot more of red X's on his goals that he didn't accomplish than green check marks that he did accomplish out there. But I do think it's a big moment for him to step into. He talked that it was more about joy than the relief that we saw out of Rory McIlroy a week earlier. But I do think there's a lot of relief in it for Justin Thomas as well. And you can make an argument now that I would make an argument he's actually the best American player of his generation. Now, he's got a couple of years head start, obviously, on Scottie Scheffler in terms of racking up those wins. Yeah. And Scottie may well pass him in short order. But if you're looking at that sort of famous class of 2011 that merged onto the PGA Tour, I don't see anybody who's really doing what Justin Thomas has. The 16 wins, the 2 majors, the Players' Championship, constant FedEx Cup presence, FedEx Cup champion.
Yeah, and a lot of momentum heading into the meat of the season. And one thing he's talked about a lot the last few years has been the putter and not being so mechanical, being too wooden and trying to fix things. And look at the improvement that he's had from 2024 to 2025, 174th in strokes gained putting to 24th, the average distance of putts made, the improvement from putting from 20 to 25 feet. And yesterday after his round, he talked about the road to improvement with the flat stick.
Statistically, this is the best you've putted in years. What's behind the improvement that you've seen?
I'd say, I told Todd this a couple days ago. We were talking about it. It just is, obviously, it's a lot of work and time spent on it. But, I mean, a huge help. I called Xander at the end of last year because I think he's one of the best putters and fundamentals, and not just putting, but everything. And I just was like, can I just pick your brain for like 2 or 3 hours, just talk to you about putting? And so he came out with me, and then he just was asking me a bunch of different questions. And I mean, you guys obviously know Xander, but he doesn't leave any box unchecked. He's going to, like he said that day, he's like, if it has anything to do with you potentially improving in golf, I've probably done it or tried it. And so I just was talking to him about his process and how he reads greens and how he sees things and his practice and everything. And it honestly was just being with him, and he would kind of ask something, and I was like, well, yeah, you know, like I used to do that. And then it was like, well, how about something like this? Like, yeah, you know, I used to use the string line here. Okay. And then it just, the more I was talking, I'm like, I don't do any of the things that I used to do my best putting years, like 2017, 18. I was very, very regimented of the things that I did, and how he said it is I had a home base and I had no home base. I had things that I did, but it was a very vague bag of things and there was no consistency to it. And I feel like I used to have a very good home base of fundamentals and things that I did. So it honestly, while he helped, it was more of the questions he asked made me realize that I'm trying basically too hard and I'm trying too many different things versus I think it's a serious, serious, serious skill to continue to work on the things that you do really well and not doing it differently. And I think that's been more of what it is. It's just I have my fundamentals and things that I do and checkpoints and I'm sticking to them.
Interesting dynamic here, Damon. You have a guy who won two majors last year helping a guy who's going to be one of his biggest challenges this year to keeping those major titles. Maybe it's a generational thing with these guys. You know, we saw Rory offer putting advice to Scottie Scheffler last year. It's not how it used to be in the old days. I mean, I'm guessing Tiger had his favorites, but you know, Curtis Strange wouldn't have given you a Heimlich if you'd needed one back in the 80s. It definitely must be a generational thing.
I think so. I think there's also something to the fact that these guys want to beat the best at their best. You know, Rory's going to want to beat Scotty when Scotty is, you know, in full flight. Xander and JT, they can be buddies, but they want to beat each other when they're, you know, absolutely at the top of their game. And I'm talking Jack versus Tom Watson, 1977 Turnberry. And I love what JT said about doing the fundamentals over and over again. I listen to this podcast, it's a tennis podcast, Jonathan Stokey, Baseline Intelligence. And one thing he says is, don't worry about adding new tennis strokes. Work on the basics and do them over and over again. And I think JT, by his own admission, was kind of lost in the wilderness. Well, this is not working, so I'm going to try this. This didn't work, so I'm going to try that. Instead of working with what was working so well in 2017 and 2018, when he was the best player in the world and winning majors and winning FedEx Cup titles and shooting nothing out there, 59s and setting course records, and to go back to using the string on the putting green that Xander Schauffele told him. I love that. It's not about looking for the next wrinkle all the time. It's about the boring, repetitive fundamentals and doing them again and again and again.
And sometimes it can be tough to, you know, leave the trail of breadcrumbs to find your way back to where you were in the past. I mean, he's only been in the top 100, maybe even I think the top 150 in putting once in the last 6 years. He was a long way removed from where he was, and scar tissue builds up on stuff like that as well. And you would see JT at tour event after tour event, and the amount of time he was putting in on the putting green, often with his dad, Mike, was exponentially more than what he was putting in on the range. And, he didn't need to. He's consistently top 10 strokes gained approach for almost his entire career on the PGA Tour. He had a drop-off in his sort of driver play last year on tour, all the way down to 117th. Now he's kind of back in his regular top 50 spot. But that jump that we've seen in the putting is enormous. And that, to me, makes me think he's going to upend another stat that we've seen. He's made 11 major championship appearances since he won that PGA in 22 at Southern Hills. He's only had one top 10 in that time. He's also played the Players pretty poorly since he won it in 21 as well. I think those big events where you do end up going toe-to-toe with the best players in the world, I think that's his next target.
And those putts, left-to-right putts, on 15 and 18, those would have gone into the front edge of a teacup and a children's play set. I mean, those were perfectly struck putts. And the left-to-right putt for a right-handed putter is supposed to be so difficult. We saw Jon Rahm, height of power, make left-to-right putts at Torrey Pines to win the U.S. Open. I had a little bit of that kind of echo watching JT go about his business yesterday afternoon.
It is the putter that makes or breaks you in this game. And as we all know, there's never too much distance between ecstasy and despair in elite golf. Sunday tends to bring both, and yesterday was no exception. Joel Damon came painfully close to a win in the Dominican Republic, and he spoke with pretty raw honesty when it didn't happen. You're going to hear that next.
Back on golf today, there was an additional field event last week on the tour, Corrales Punta Cana Championship in the beautiful Dominican Republic, and Joel Damon had quite the week up to a point. Solo lead each of the first three rounds. Set or tie tournament, 18, 36, and 54-hole. Scoring records held the largest 36-hole lead and 54-hole lead in tournament history. And he'd won there before final round 76, allowing Garrett Hego to win for the second time on the PGA Tour. And there you see Hego's even par, 72 was enough for the win. After the round, Joel met with the media and was transparent and quite raw.
I think I'm in a little bit of shock, honestly. It's not how you win a golf tournament, I'll tell you that. I don't deserve to win it. You know, bogey in the last three is inexcusable. I mean, in middle of the fairway with an 8-iron 16 to hit it where I hit it. You can't, it was tough up and down over there. I don't know what happened on the short one on 17. I mean, I'm obviously nervous, but unfortunately, I'm prone to that at times. It's, you call it a lapse in concentration. It's not like a yippy thing. It's not like one of those things, but bad time to do it. And then 18 is just a really hard hole, man. We had 220 pin and wind surfed on it and hit a very average chip. I hit a good putt. I actually thought it was a straight putt and broke a little left on me. And all of a sudden I wake up and I lost my golf tournament. So, and it honestly, it doesn't even, you can look at these last three holes and, but once again, I three putted two, basically three putted five again today, hit it in a bunker on seven. Yesterday I made plenty of mistakes. So it's one of those things where, what, 15 under win?
14.
14-1.
I don't know what else to say, but I guess going next week to play with Harry Higgs, a friend of yours, is that going to give you some comfort next week?
This one could take a while to get over. Sorry about that. You know, it's one of those things you learn more in defeat, unfortunately. I don't know what I'm going to learn from this yet. I'm, like I said, I still think I'm in a little bit of shock. Felt like I was in a good headspace. I was in a good headspace, but sometimes your body doesn't cooperate. Kept really calm and cool out there, even when, you know, you three putt 13 and miss a short one on 12, you're still fine. I'm still putting the ball in play. I'm still giving myself opportunities. So, but yeah, for next week, I mean, it's probably the best week for me next week is to have fun, have someone to rely on, have someone else's ball in play. It's going to be a great trip with my wife's coming in town without her kids. So we're going to have a great 4 days of just enjoying each other. And this one's going to sting for a while.
Watching you on television on the back nine, it was hard to tell whether you were like trying to stay stoic and just walk slowly and calm yourself down or whether you were churning inside with nerves. Was it a bit
certainly,
of both? Or
certainly was as nervous. And I think in the past I've tried to fight against it. And recently I've tried to take it more head on. Like when you're nervous, embrace, and you have the adrenaline, like attack that and embrace it and run with that. It's like the first round, you know, there's a little bit of adrenaline when you're shooting 62, but you're attacking and you're going after it. And today I want to be on the offense. And I really did. I mean, I was obviously, you have to control your breathing a little bit and try to control your heart rate, but at the same time you're attacking and you're playing offense. And I tried to stay aggressive with my golf swings. I did, but just didn't work out. Sucks.
Wow. You know, as folks who walk around with notebooks like we do, I mean, I love that post-round interview in this era where we're talking about, well, how much do the players owe the media and the public, and it can't be easy to have your heart broken that way. I just appreciate the rawness, the honesty that Joel presented. This is someone who's talked about, you know, the fine line between having a PGA Tour card and not, and what he went through in the fall at the RSM to narrowly get his card, and saying, I couldn't imagine not raising my kids on the PGA Tour. He just loves having his family with him. That's what I thought about when I watched him lose that lead and watched him kind of explain what happened in his mind.
Yeah, I think it's a great testament to Joel Damon. I mean, everybody's happy to talk when they have a trophy in their hand. Yeah. Everyone's happy to talk when they've just signed their name to a really low score on the PGA Tour. It takes a lot more character and a lot more professionalism to stand up when you've just had your teeth kicked in, as he did on those last few holes, because it means a great deal. And because it is an additional event on the PGA Tour, the prize fund is lower, the FedEx Cup points are lower, but those guys who play in that event, they're hungry for those points because they know how difficult it's going to be to maintain that top 100 position, to keep their card this year. That was a big week for Joel Damon, but it's also a reminder of why he's become an easy guy to root for. And that was, I think, established somewhat even before the first Netflix show, because here's a guy who's seen enough of the downside of life to actually have some perspective and know that winning or losing a golf tournament isn't necessarily the biggest thing in the world, even if it did feel like a pretty big thing yesterday.
Well, these guys all bring a unique perspective, a unique story to the profession. I mean, by watching him lose, I think that creates a possibility for a redemptive arc. Why did so many people watch Rory McIlroy? Why did he transcend the game at the Masters? It's because of the heartbreak. Sure, we love watching him drive. We know one of the players and the talent, but everybody knew the what was missing over the last 11 years. And to have that moment a couple of Sundays ago, I think it's similar with Joel Damon. The loss for him, it's a smaller tournament, it's smaller stakes, but not for Joel Damon. It's every bit as important to him as what Rory accomplished, to get a second PGA Tour win, to maybe give yourself more, you know, runway for your professional career. And I think that gives you an opportunity as a golf fan to say, hey, I want to watch this guy and see what happens to him next week and the week after that and what happens to his future down the road.
And how refreshing is it to see a professional athlete these days stand up and own his shortcomings in the moment? Yeah. There was no attempt to blame anybody else. There was no attempt to find mitigating circumstances. Mm. He talked about how he is prone to missing those short putts, the lapse of concentration once in a while, but the ability to own his own moment in that kind of situation, I think, stands pretty good testimony to him as well. And we're going to continue this conversation now with a Golf Today roundtable as we welcome in Golf Channel senior writer Ryan Lavner and Joel Beale. Joel is a Golf Digest senior writer and also the author of a new book, Playing Dirty, Rediscovering Golf's Soul in Scotland in an Age of Sportswashing and Civil War. And I can tell you, I highly recommend that one from Joel. Joel, I want to start with you just looking at that Joel Damon footage yesterday. There's just been ongoing conversation in golf now for several weeks, initiated by Colin Morikawa, in terms of the obligations or responsibilities golfers have to talk in tough moments afterwards. Was that a reminder yesterday that these are the moments that actually make people root for golfers, is when they do actually talk about the pain outside the ropes as opposed to just the shots they hit inside?
Absolutely. And what we saw yesterday from Joel made me rethink my position. You know, I throughout this controversy, and it's not just Morikawa, right? There are other big names who've blown off interviews when things don't go well. You know, my previous standpoint had been, hey, this is a little overblown. You know, from a media standpoint, if you need a quote or a soundbite to do your job, you might not be doing your job correctly. But Damon is the counter, because he showed us why it's important to talk after a round. As you guys mentioned, he's already a fan favorite. Trust me, I know. Sometimes I'll follow him just to hear "You're the man, Joel" cheers and act like they're actually for me and not him. So he has definitely been a fan favorite. And what we saw yesterday, facing the music afterwards, would have been very easy and understandable to run and hide. I think it only engenders more empathy. It also reminds us these guys are people, not robots that we are watching. Afterwards, he mentioned he learns more from defeat than victory. I think we learned more from Damon in that moment than we would have if he ended up holding out and winning the tournament yesterday.
How about you, Lav? From your perspective, someone who writes prolifically, features, game stories, what was the value of Joel Damon's post-round chat yesterday?
Yeah, I don't think that players necessarily owe us anything as media members, but it's often instructive and illuminating when they do talk. And everyone goes back to the Colin Morikawa incident, what happened at Bay Hill, blowing off the media. That happens in golf. That happens in other sports as well. But it's also worth remembering that Colin Morikawa met with reporters 2 days later at TPC Sawgrass, and he was fantastic in detailing what went wrong on Sunday, what has been sort of dogging him the last couple of years, why he can't get over the hump, the process that he's going through. And I thought Joel Damon on Sunday, sort of in real time in Punta Cana, did the exact same thing. How he was feeling, what he was thinking over the shots, how long this is going to take him to get over it. It just gives fans a greater understanding of these players and what makes them tick. And I'm grateful and appreciative of players like Joel and Damon, who can do that, you know, 5 minutes after signing the scorecard and bogeying his last three holes to kick away the tournament. I realize not every player can do that. And I think that's why some PGA Tour players probably do deserve some sort of grace. And I think it's worth a conversation whether there should be some sort of cooling off period. But the players who can do it and sort of process that shock and disappointment in real time, I think as golf observers, we're all better off for it.
Joel, I want to follow up on this. And I asked this question with a bit of trepidation because I'm often interviewing them after their rounds, good and bad. Should there be a 10-minute cooling off period. You know, I covered the NBA, covered the NFL, the locker room's closed. Then they open it up to the media. Should there be a little bit longer? And I'm not sure I want this myself because I need to talk to them sometimes before the top of the hour, for example. But do you think there should be a grace period of time for them to reflect and cool off?
Personally, if they want it, I think we give them that grace. I actually think it's to their detriment, though. I think you get the more raw emotion immediately after it happened. Also, you never know if an agent at that point can intervene and, you know, maybe tell them what to say. I think getting them right after whatever just happened, it happened, we get a truer sense of how they're feeling and who they are as people. So from a mental health standpoint, I would, whatever they need to feel comfortable talking, give it to them. But I actually think it's better for them if they talk immediately after the moment.
Well, we're going to continue this conversation after the break. We're going to talk a little JT, and I can see Joel's got his clubs behind him right there. So he's probably got a tee time that he needs to get to, but we'll be right back.
Back on Golf Today, folks. You're in the market for a podcast. Check out the Golf Channel podcast with Rex Hoggard and Ryan Lavender. And if you miss any of Golf Today, you can find our best interviews on the Golf Today podcast. And be sure to subscribe to the Golf Channel YouTube page as well. We continue our conversation roundtable style with Ryan Lavender and Joel Beal. Lav, we've both covered Justin Thomas for a long time, some highs and lows. What did you learn about JT this past week?
Damon, I love what he said on the 18th green afterward to CBS, that winning is really hard, and he probably took it for granted when he went in that torrid run in the mid to late 2010s. You know, over the last year and a half, there wasn't anything technical that was keeping Justin Thomas out of the winner's circle. And you look at the strong final rounds he had, whether it was last fall at the Zozo Championship, earlier this year at the American Express, or the Valspar Championship. He shot 66 or lower in all of those rounds to give himself a chance. And JT, Damon, you've covered him as long as I have. Like, he has a tendency to put too much pressure on himself and be too hard on himself. He knows what he can do. He's done it his entire life, dating all the way back to a junior golfer when he was a world beater at that level. There's always been a natural temptation for him to push too hard to get across the finish line. But JT, over the past year and a half in particular, has really preached patience, knew he was playing great, and then the results would follow. I think that's why it was such a satisfying victory for him. And you saw the emotions pour out on Sunday.
Joel, it was a 72-man event, a signature event on the tour. And I'm curious what you think about having signature events after majors. I asked Ryan about this when we chatted on the show last week. And by the time he was done talking, he was advocating cutting 8 weeks out of the PGA Tour schedule. He got way out over his skis on this one. Where are you on the idea of having an event of this stature come the week after a major, because we're going to see it again right after the U.S. Open with the Travelers?
Yeah, personally, I'm not a fan. I feel like we need to give the top players a chance to decompress after a big week. I mean, heck, I don't know about you boys. I felt like I needed a week off just watching the Masters, although that probably speaks more to my fitness and ungodly diet than anything else. But yeah, I understand the tour's worry that a week without an event will be filled by a competitor. But if signature events are supposed to mean something more, putting them directly behind, and honestly, in front of too, you know, as an Ohio guy, I feel like the Memorial kind of lost some pizzazz the past couple of years, being right next to the U.S. Open. It just feels like we need these signature events a chance, give them a chance to breathe a little bit, to make them as good as they can be.
Lav, we've got 4 months nearly of PGA Tour golf behind us. We've had the Players. We've had our first major championship. In your mind, you know, what's working for the PGA Tour? It seems like a lot is going well. And what needs fixing, you know, foremost in your mind?
I mean, Rory McIlroy is working. This is the biggest star on the PGA Tour, and he's off to the best start he's ever had in his PGA Tour career. I think it only ratchets up the anticipation for what he could possibly do over the next couple of months. I mean, you'd love to see some of these other marquee names on the PGA Tour. Justin Thomas certainly did his part at the RBC Heritage. We're still winless from Scottie Scheffler. We're still winless from Xander Schauffele. Those are sort of two key protagonists from the 2024 season. If you're for the PGA Tour, you want to build momentum from year to year, create rivalries, create storylines. I think that's the potential that you could have over these next couple of months. Whereas, you know, over the past couple of years, it's been who can unseat Scottie Scheffler. Now you have the most dynamic player on the PGA Tour who's playing some of the best golf of his career. Can other players sort of step up and challenge him in the major championships and the marquee events as well?
Ryan, let's talk about this plaid jacket that Justin Thomas got yesterday. You are a fashion icon. You're well known for that. in media centres. This thing looks like it was stripped off the clubhouse bar couch in a Scottish clubhouse in the 1970s. I propose in a motion here that one garment be given out in all of golf, and that was the green jacket given out 2 weeks ago. There's no plaid here, no plaid at Colonial, no alpaca sweater at Bay Hill, nothing else. Will you second the motion?
I will not. I don't even pick out my own clothes. At first it was my mother, then it was my college girlfriend, and now it is my wife. I'm completely and utterly colorblind. I have no sense of fashion. I have no sense of style. I have no sense of colors. So no, I will not be weighing in on this debate.
Joel, how about you? Can we count on you at least?
I'm more amazed that Ladner had a girlfriend in college.
Oh, man.
That is the shot of the weekend right there.
You teed him up perfectly. I like the tartan, and I like the plaid. Joel, don't you like it? I mean, listen, I like having lots of jackets. By the way, Scottie Scheffler loves winning all the jackets, truthfully.
I'm with Amy. Just green jackets is the one that should be given out. I understand the history behind them, but one garment, let's stick with one garment. We're good.
All right, Lav, I got one more for you. You know, since we're talking a lot about Rory McIlroy, at what percentage would you put the chances for an in-season Grand Slam? Is it 0.1%? Is it 1%? Is it as high as 25%? What would you put it at?
Really, we're going there this
time. I'm going there. I've been gone for a while, Eamon, as you know.
I mean, it is a ridiculous notion. Of course, it would be a super slam since he did win the Players' Championship as well. Normally, I would say this is a ridiculous premise. I'm not even going to give it any sort of oxygen. However, when you look at the upcoming major championship venues, Quail Hollow, a golf course where he's won 4 times, Oakmont, I'm not sure you could design a better U.S. Open venue for a player with his skill set, and then a return home to Royal Portrush and the Open Championship. I mean, it's only going to ratchet up the intensity and the pressure and the anticipation. Maybe less than 5%. I don't feel great about that, but boy, if he wins the PGA Championship, can you imagine the amount of tension we're going to be experiencing as media members as we arrive at Oakmont for the U.S. Open?
Guys, it's always good to catch up. And if Lav's college girlfriend is out there, you have our sympathy all these years later.
Hi, Cara.
Thanks, guys.
Hi, Cara. All right, folks. After the break, we'll count down the 9 best shots of the week that was golf today. And girlfriend talk, back in a flash.
It was an impressive showing for Andrew Novak in Hilton Head. He played in the final group for the 3rd time this season, which is the most of any player on tour. Finished runner-up at the RBC Heritage, losing to Justin Thomas in a playoff. That was his first appearance in a playoff. Solo second-place finish is his 2nd runner-up finish. His 99th start, 3 top 3 finishes this year, tied with several other players, not least Rory McIlroy, who's got 3 first-place finishes on tour this year. And afterwards, Novak sounded appreciative of his good play, but a little bit impatient.
I need to go out there and get a win at some point. But yeah, all of these finishes are great. I mean, I have big goals for the year. Obviously, like, this is going to look good for Captain Keegan, and I've got a lot more to do as far as that. But I'm putting my name up there, and next step is just to win.
Andrew Novak climbing the official world golf ranking. Look where he was in the fall, 155th. Look where he is now, 34th. Great chance to compete in the final 3 majors of 2025. He only played in 1 major back in 2022, U.S. Open at the Country Club in Brookline, Massachusetts. And Eamon, I've interviewed him a couple times during my time on the road. He's got protagonist, main character energy. He wants to be there, believes he belongs there. I love what he said afterwards. His main emotion was more pride as opposed to disappointment. It was a home game for him. He's excited about Quail Hollow, you know, from Raleigh, went to Wofford College. So he's got some big goals, including making Keegan Bradley's Ryder Cup team, which I thought was pretty strong for a player who hasn't won on the PGA Tour to put that out there.
Yeah, he certainly got the protagonist potential, but he's also a poster boy for the way the tour kind of drew up its pathways for members, because he has actually played the last 4 signature events on the PGA Tour, and he's gotten into the field all 4 times, not because of he got a free pass on a sponsor's exemption or anything else. He earned his way. He played his way in week to week out there, and that's sort of evidenced by even, you look at the last 2 events he's played. He was tied 3rd at Valero, tied 2nd at RBC. Makes you wonder what he would have done had he been eligible for the Masters the week in between those 2 tournaments. But I think the fact that he's earning his spot week in, week out, and then capitalizing on it is a really good sign. We've just seen how the world ranking numbers have gone for him. Another few numbers in his really show how, a guy that's getting extremely comfortable out there. When he joined the tour a couple of years ago, he was 129th off the tee. Right now, he's 46th, comfortably in the top 50. He's top 11 on tour in strokes gained around the green. He was outside the top 100 a couple of years ago, and he's pretty much a middle-of-the-pack putter, top 60 on tour. That's a pretty good combination out there. He's not the longest guy in the world.
He's not.
There's 115 guys out there longer than him. He's still, in fairness, just shy of 300 yards, even at 116th on tour. But he has all the weapons, and he clearly has a little bit of belief. I never got the sense yesterday that he was wobbling under the pressure at all. He obviously didn't make that putt on the last hole of regulation when he had an eight-footer to win. But he does seem more and more comfortable week after week.
Yeah, and he went toe-to-toe with one of the best players of this generation in Justin Thomas and lived to tell about it. Hit some great shots down the stretch. Saw what Justin Thomas was doing and had to make that birdie, you know, on 15, or make the birdie on 16. And then the great shot in regulation as well. And think about the shots we've seen throughout the history of this tournament on the 18th. You know, Davis missing it to the right and having to chip in. We've seen Cantlay in the bunker and Kuchar in the bunker. And, you know, we've seen players, Brian Davis missing a short left in the long ago playoff with Jim Furyk. It's not the easiest approach shot, especially when the wind is up. I think he's going to take a lot of positives from how he played, especially down the stretch.
It's hard to think of two more diverse tests of golf than Harbortown versus TPC San Antonio. Mm. He's been top three in both of those finishes in his last two starts on the PGA Tour. This is a guy whose game travels pretty well.
Andrew Novak wants to be at Bethpage Black. I imagine Rory McIlroy will be at Bethpage Black. We're making the turn on golf today. Rory back in action this week, making his first start following that incredible Masters win. Plus, an early look at the odds entering next men's major when Golf Today returns.
Justin Thomas turned a famine into a feast yesterday. He snapped a three-year victory drought with a playoff win at the RBC Heritage. Is a third PGA Championship on the cards for him next month at Quail Hollow. And Rory McIlroy is back in action this week, fresh off his Masters success, and he only has to hit half the shots. He and Shane Lowry will defend their title at the Zurich Classic in New Orleans, the only team event on the PGA Tour. And as the LPGA Tour readies for its first major of the season, former Chevron champion Amy Alcott joins the show. She's got as many majors as McIlroy. Golf Today rolls into Hour 2.
Golf Today.
Welcome back into Hour 2 of Golf Today. Eamon Lynch alongside Damon Hack, who's finally returned from his road trip. But you were out there to watch some pretty impressive winners over the last few weeks. Just the last 2 weeks alone, you've got Justin Thomas, Rory McIlroy, you had Victor Hovland a couple of weeks before that. You got to like the swagger that's coming back on the PGA Tour these days.
It's golf season, Eamon. It feels like golf season. Joel Beal had his clubs behind him, as you pointed out, ready to go play some golf. It's springtime. The country's kind of digging out of the winter, and we've had some incredible storylines, I think, so far in the first 4 months of this season. Some big-time winners, some great duels, some heartbreak and disappointment, but what we saw in the first major championship on the men's side was just incredible. I'm still trying to make sense of it all.
I think a lot of people are still trying to make sense of everything that happened that day.
Can you believe it? A little over a week ago, since the golf world witnessed history at Augusta National Golf Club, Rory winning the Masters, completing the career Grand Slam, just the sixth man to do it. He did not tee up last week's RBC Heritage, but guess what? Rory is back, returning to the PGA Tour this week. And why not? 1 year ago, he and his good buddy Shane Lowry back to TPC Louisiana, defending their title at the Zurich Classic of New Orleans, official team tournament on the tour, the regular season. You remember last year they were singing Steve Perry, Journey, Don't Stop Believing? I mean, it was just so good. They got the beads going. Wait for Shane. You know, Rory wasn't shy. Shane was a little shy. Shane had the beer. Rory had the beer too, but this was a lot of fun. I think maybe one of the most important wins in this tournament's history. Those guys partied into Sunday night. rightfully so.
And if they defend, Shane, it's your time to grab the microphone and sing. Rory and Shane obviously defending their title here. The notable teams in the field this week in New Orleans, a couple of brothers there, Matt and Alex Fitzpatrick. And thoughts and prayers for the announced team, because this is a week when Rasmus and Nikolai Højgaard are probably going to be dressing the same as well.
Yeah, and it's an incredible time, at least for me, to reflect on what Rory McIlroy did a little over.
Yeah, we haven't actually talked since the Masters. What did you make of that stress-inducing Sunday?
I mean, it was incredible to watch a guy who had said, I will go through 100 Sundays, 100 heartbreaks to have one more chance to win a major. He went through 100 Sundays in one Sunday. It was the ebb and flow, the high and low, the mistakes, the majesty. I mean, Rory gave us everything. And it's a reminder that you don't have to play your A game to win. I think his pressure that he faced was as unique a pressure as anyone in sports would face. Everybody on the property knew what was at stake. The patrons knew. Social media knew. You couldn't walk past Rory on Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday and not think about what he was thinking about it. You knew it. He knew it. Every question. I talked to him on Tuesday. He said it was a childhood dream to win the Masters. He said, I said it on a video in Northern Ireland as an 8-year-old. I want to win all the majors. This question shadowed him every single month, every single major. And I love how he opened up his presser on Sunday night. What are we going to talk about now? It was perfect.
Wasn't it also quite telling that on the final putt in the graphics from CBS broadcast, where you normally see for birdie for par, it read for career grand slam.
Yeah.
But you just don't ever see the weight of the accomplishment added in there as well. But I honestly couldn't think of an example of somebody who accomplished what they set out to accomplish under greater scrutiny. And under greater pressure than what McIlroy did last week, because to your point, it has followed him for 11 years almost at this point. And I think it's weightier because of where that career Grand Slam had to be accomplished. Jordan's going to feel a little bit of that questioning when we get to Quail Hollow in a few weeks for the PGA as his only missing leg. But it's very different to go back year after year to the same golf course where you're not only familiar with your own demons, but you're familiar with all of the other demons from all of these greats like Tom Weisskopf and Johnny Miller and Ernie Els and Greg Norman, who repeatedly came up short. They could win everywhere else, but Augusta National seemed to hobble some of the greatest players who've ever played this game.
And the choices were so stark. It's catastrophe or it is living legend. There was no in-between for Rory. It's either going to be the most crushing, heartbreaking loss for a guy who's had a lot
from
of questioning.
It literally oscillated
like
that.
It was why we love this game, but times a thousand. It was everything. The shot making, the horror of 13, the brilliance of 15, and the celebration on 18 was just, if you love this game, and then even the heartbreak first of the missed putt. Oh, is this Pinehurst all over again? No, it's not Pinehurst. This is the sixth man ever to complete the career Grand Slam, to do it in the shadows of those loblolly and Georgia pines. Your scriptwriter couldn't have written any better.
Man, if there's going to be a sequel to that, I can't imagine what it's going to be, but I look forward to watching it. And here are the most PGA Tour wins in the last 10 seasons on the PGA Tour. And these are the two guys at the top of that list. 18 for Rory McIlroy. His most recent, of course, coming just last week. And then this week, Justin Thomas, with this playoff putt, sealed victory. Became the first 18-hole leader or co-leader to win on tour this season through 18 events. Also moves from number 8 to number 6 in the official World Golf ranking. And after the win, he spoke with Todd Lewis.
Let's talk about confidence. Just about 3 years ago, you and I were at Southern Hills talking after you...
Feels like a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. And I didn't think it would take that long for you to win again. How much did you have to overcome self-doubt?
You and me both. A lot. I think that's probably been the biggest, I don't want to say issue, biggest hurdle for me. It's a lot of doubt. It's a lot of fear of, you know, I know I have the capability and the talent to keep winning and win more, but it just because you have that and think that doesn't mean it's going to happen. So it's really just trying to keep practicing, keep putting myself in contention and really just trying to get over that. I mean, it's so easy to say, but man, it can be so hard to do when you get in those situations. And I feel like the last couple of years, I mean, yeah, I had a lot of crappy golf and it sucked, but you know, I feel like I've learned from it and will continue to learn from it. And I'm sure I'll have more learning experiences in my career, but just got to keep my head down. I'm just so excited to do this and get this done and keep building for the rest of the season.
Yeah, how you validated all that hard work and overcoming those fears. What are the emotions here to get this done?
It's a lot. I definitely don't want to put myself in the same comparison as Rory last week, but I felt it when he said relief. And I mean, I told him that when I, seeing his reaction, like there's not very many reactions. I feel like after a win, a victory like that, that is just pure joy and emotion like that. Obviously we all have that, but you don't get those kind of situations and scenarios very often. And that was more exciting than I even thought. It was like after that first initial fist pump and kind of hugging Joe, it's like I turned around and I'm just like, oh my God, finally, like I did it and won. And take it for granted sometimes, but it's fun to win.
And like Rory McIlroy, JT has a lot to look forward to. His first major came at the 2017 PGA at Quail Hollow. He beat Patrick Reed, Francesco Molinari, and Louis Oosthuizen by a couple shots. Quail, of course, the site of the next men's major. How about the odds? Who do you like? Scottie Scheffler, though, he's been joined. Usually it's been him at the top all by himself, but now he and Rory, 5-1. There's Xander, terrific record at Quail, 11-1. John Rahm, 12-1, along with Big Bad Bryson. There's Ludwig. There's JT, 18-1, alongside Brooks. There you see Victor and Colin Morikawa as well. The odds via DraftKings. Now listen, Tom Brady versus Peyton Manning, Michael versus Magic, Magic versus Bird. You need the Brahma Bulls to have Rory and JT both with a reason to claim great momentum and confidence going into the second men's major. Sign me up, Eamon. I cannot wait for Quail Hollow.
And you know, it's just lighting a fire under Scottie Scheffler and probably Xander Schauffele as well. But the narratives are writing themselves when we get to the majors. You had Rory winning the AT&T at Pebble Beach, winning the Players on the way to the Masters, built up a tremendous amount of expectation and pressure. He delivered. Now you've got JT returning to a major. He's won twice in the last 8 years at a golf course where he actually won his first major and has often played pretty well out there. It really is setting up a scenario where we're going to get another heavyweight duel, because there are so many guys in form, but there are also guys who are actually kind of plotting their way back into form. Xander, particularly one of those guys, and Scottie Scheffler, who keeps saying he's not that far off right now. He keeps finishing top 10 without that win, but there aren't many more competitive guys out there with something to prove than Scottie Scheffler.
Justin Thomas once told me the best golf shot he ever hit was the final day, 17th hole, 2017 PGA at Quail, on the way to winning that major championship.
Not a good memory for him in that golf course. Well, it's been 50 years since Amy Alcott turned professional right out of high school in Los Angeles. Heck of a career. 29 LPGA Tour wins, 5 majors, 3 of them came in the Chevron Championship, which begins on Thursday. Amy will join us next.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
We're back on Golf Today, and a new winner was crowned on the LPGA Tour last night. Ingrid Lindblad won the JM Eagle LA Championship, just her third start and only her second made cut. Along the way, she set the 72-hole LPGA Tour scoring record at El Caballero Country Club with a four-day total of 267.
Tell you what, Eamon, she's trending at the right time as the week marks the first major of 2025, the women's golf, the Chevron Championship. This is the third year the Chevron will be playing at the club at Carlton Woods in Houston after having moved from California prior to the 2023 tournament. But back to 1983, first edition of the tournament as a major, Amy Alcott won by a couple shots over Beth Daniel and Kathy Whitworth. She notably created the famed leap into Pompey's Pond after her second win at Mission Hills and continued the tradition after her third victory there, which was her final win on the LPGA Tour. That bio is so strong, Hall of Fame worthy, multiple majors, Rookie of the Year back in 1975, a highly decorated career. And the World Golf Hall of Fame member joins us now. Amy, always great to spend some time with you. You're in Houston. We dig into another major championship week on the professional landscape. You won 5 majors, and you won a U.S. Women's Open by 9, and you won the old Dyna 1 year by 8. How did you peak for those important weeks? What advice would you give to the modern player?
Well, great memories for me, obviously, to win those tournaments by those kind of margins. To win by 1 is exciting, but to win by a landslide is great. I think you just have to stay in your own zone. You know, people try to recreate the zone when they're not in it, but it's called a bubble now. I know people use that term, but you know, when you're playing well and you're going with it, things happen during the course of a week that you can't let your highs get too high and your lows get too low. You just got to stick with it and know that something might happen, you know, down the line. But you can't win the tournament on Thursday or Friday or Saturday. You gotta be there in the final 9.
Amy, this is the 3rd year for the Chevron Championship being in Houston after 50 years in the California desert. I'm guessing it has to find and settle on a new identity versus the one it had for so long. Do you feel as though it is actually getting an identity in Houston at this point?
I think that they're working, Chevron is working very hard to kind of build that centric point here, that it is in their home territory now. I know, obviously, myself and a lot of people miss it being in the desert. I get letters all the time. But Carlton Woods is a terrific golf course. It's kind of like the event is really building a new brand and challenging holes, good left to right holes, right to left holes. It's a very, very nice venue. Great finishing hole, obviously, with the water. But it will garner some great play, I know, this week. And, I think Chevron's doing a great job to, you know, have this first major be stellar. So they're doing a terrific job.
Well, so many majors, Amy, as you know, they have great history, legacy, tradition, whether it's champions, dinners, or at the old course, for example, they had the beautiful loop that some of the past champions got to play, like Tiger and Jack Nicklaus a few years ago. What types of things are you seeing kind of off the course to kind of build a legacy in Houston?
Well, yesterday we had an event that I host for Chevron every year that has carried on from the desert. I started many years ago called the Junior Legacy event, where we have a bunch of great young junior golfers here tied in with the LPGA Girls Golf Program come in and play with 16 either former champions of this tournament, Hall of Famers, and other great winners. We had a great event yesterday, and we feel like, you know, junior golf is really the lifeblood of the game. It was for me when I started pushing balls into sprinkler heads. So I know where inspiration can come from, and you never know quite where that is. But for these young gals to meet a Hall of Famer and be able to pick their mind was a great thing. They also have a terrific dinner tonight, hosted by Thomas Keller, who's a fabulous chef. They really are doing it upright to, build this event up. So just certain little traditions that they're getting going.
Well, any day that Thomas Keller is making your dinner is a pretty good day. Amy, there was a big announcement last week that the Olympics is going to have a mixed team event in Los Angeles at one of your clubs at Riviera in 2028. How big a deal is that in your mind, just to showcase the women's game on one of the biggest platforms available?
Well, I think the coming to Riviera is a fabulous, I don't have to tell you what a great course that is. I grew up sneaking under the fence there when I was 13. So to be a member there is a wonderful thing. As far as the women playing there, also the U.S. Open will be coming there. But I love team events, and I think that's just what's going on in the game of golf. People are looking for excitement and content, and you know, we I played in many team events with different great players, Hale Irwin and along the way. And I think it's a wonderful addition to the Olympic Games to, you know, bring the women's, men's and women's game together and kind of showcase them for the public, for public interest, not just kind of keep them apart, but, you know, do, you know, have these events where you can see both games and have people team together. Love the idea.
Speaking of LA and Riviera, Amy, you had to evacuate during the recent fires. How is your community recovering in your particular part of the community?
Well, I was about a half mile away and had to get out of there very quickly, like so many people. Gratefully, my house is still standing. Did have obviously some smoke damage that I've become my own great contractor. you know, smoke remediation, ductwork cleaning, windows cleaning, all the things, HEPA filtering. Our little community in Santa Monica Canyon is so grateful to be standing, but there's so many people I know, and especially in the golf world, at various golf courses and country clubs around LA that have, I know, that have lost their home. Just a myriad of people who I really feel awful for that are having to rebuild. So I'm very grateful, but my little putting green is still standing, and just a lot of cleanup work, but very grateful.
Well, Amy, you kept so many of us in the golf media aware of your whereabouts and what was going on during that difficult time for Los Angeles. Shifting gears for a moment, I'm just curious how much you watch the LPGA these days. You played in such an incredible era alongside the likes of Nancy Lopez and Betsy King, Beth Daniel, Meg Mallon, it's a who's who, a Dottie Pepper. That was the golden era of the LPGA as far as I'm concerned. What do you see when you watch the modern LPGA?
Absolutely. You know, being here yesterday at the Junior Legacy with the past champions, it gives us all a chance to kind of see each other and chat about what's going on. And, you know, I was talking to Sandra Palmer and Pat Bradley and Jan Stevenson yesterday. You know, we really do feel like we were in the golden era of women's golf. You know, we it was a big business still. But now it's a bigger business. You know, I always said when I was a young player, as much as I love the game and the artistry of the game, that when it became a business for me, I probably didn't want to play anymore, you know, on the tour. But I played a long time because I really understood, you know, it was a big business. But now it's... I watched the tournament yesterday on TV from Los Angeles. I was rooting for many of the players, especially young Lauren Coughlin, who I had the pleasure of hosting a year ago out at Riviera. She wanted to play Riviera, and along with another member, we played. And I was just totally impressed by the strength of her game. She's got all the shots. And the players now are very, very prepared. And the quality, the strength of their game is just, you know, off the tee. It's incredible. And, you know, their short games are good. But I still think they have a lot to learn and should tap on the phone and the ear of some older players who have the experience, because I think it could help them close the deal.
You had a tremendous career, Amy. 29 wins, 5 majors, 30 top 10s in majors. Is there one you look back on all these years later that you still think, I should have had that one?
Yes. I mean, it's those losses, that close losses that really kind of make you be a better player. You know, I won one U.S. Open. But I should have won 2 or 3. The one that probably jumps in my mind is the U.S. Women's Open in the 80s at Salem Country Club up near Boston. Tied for the lead. going into the last hole, hit a 3-wood off the tee for safety, downhill par 4, hits a sprinkler head, the luck of the draw, hits a sprinkler head, kicks dead left, almost out of bounds under a tree, had to chip out, ended up making a bogey and losing by 1. That was the only time I can ever remember going into the parking lot quietly and crying with my caddy and people that were with me, because that was just total luck of the draw, and that one really hurt.
Well, 29 times you walked into that parking lot with the trophy in your hands, including on 5 major championship weekends as well. Amy, enjoy your time in Houston, and thank you for your time with us.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Always great being with you guys.